Once they reached the Citadel, they were to restore its defunct pulley system, so that their future comings and goings would not be dependent on flight. It was how goods had been brought up from the city, back in the days of the Mazarthim. It had a basket just big enough to carry a person or two, as they'd discovered after the liberation, when the freed had used it to get back down to the ground, one trip at a time. But in the wild hours of shock and celebration that greeted the news of the god's demise, they must have forgotten to secure the ropes properly. They'd slipped from the pulleys and fallen, rendering the citadel forever, or until now, inaccessible. Today they would re-establish the link. Solzarin had said she could carry 3 passengers in addition to herself. Errol Fane and Azarine made 2, and Laszlo was offered the last place.
"Are you sure?"
he asked Errol Fane.
"But one of the Tysakane?"
"As you've no doubt observed," said Errol Fane, "the Citadel is difficult for us. We are all children in the dark."
Laszlo remembered.
"Any of them would come if I asked, but they'll be glad to be spared. You needn't come if you don't wish."
A sly glint came into his eyes.
"I can always ask Thion Nero."
"Now, that's uncalled for," said Laszlo.
"And anyway, he isn't here." Errol Fane looked around.
"No, he isn't, is he?"
Thion was, in fact, the only delegate who hadn't come to watch the launch.
"Shall I send for him?"
"No,"
said Laszlo.
"Of course I want to come."
In truth, though, he was less certain after his macabre dream.
"Just a dream,"
he told himself, glancing up at the citadel. The angle of the climbing sun snuck a slash of rays under the edges of its wings, shining a jagged shimmer along the sharp tips of the huge metal feathers.
"Everyone will die."
"Are you sure it's empty?" he blurted out, trying and failing to sound casual.
"I'm sure,"
said Errol Fane with grim finality. He softened a little.
"If you're afraid, just know that you're in good company. It's all right if you prefer to stay."
"No, I'm fine,"
Laszlo insisted. And so it was that he found himself stepping aboard a silk sleigh a scant hour later. In spite of the chill that didn't quite leave him, he was well able to marvel at this latest unfolding of his life. He, Strange the Dreamer, was going to fly. He was going to fly in the world's first functional airship, along with 2 Tysakane warriors and a Badlander mechanist who used to make firearms for Amphion warlords, up to a citadel of alien blue metal floating above the city of his dreams. In addition to the Ferengi, citizens were gathered to see them off, Suhaila included, and all were marked by the same trepidation as the Zaedin the previous evening. No one looked up. Laszlo found their fear more unsettling than ever, and was glad to be distracted by Calixte. She came over and whispered,
"Bring me a souvenir,"
she winked.
"You owe me."
"I'm not going to loot the citadel for you,"
he said, prim. And then,
"What kind of souvenir?"
His mind went at once to the god corpses they expected to find, including Izagol's. He shuddered. How long did it take for a corpse to become a skeleton? Less than 15 years, surely. But he wouldn't be breaking off any pinky bones for Calixte. Besides, Errol Fane said that Laszlo and Solzarin would wait outside, while he and Azarine did a thorough search to make sure it was safe.
"I thought you were certain it was empty," Laszlo pointed out.
"Empty of the living,"
was his comforting reply. And then they were boarding. Solzarin put on goggles that made her look like a dragonfly. Oswin gave her a kiss and loosened the mooring lines that kept the big silk pontoons firmly on the ground. They had to cast them all off at once if they wanted to rise straight and not,
You're about like drunken camels, as Oswin put it. There were safety lines that hooked to harnesses Solzarin had given them to wear, all but Errol Fane, whose shoulders were far too big for them.
Hook it on your belt, then,
said Solzarin with a frown. She peered up, squinting at the underside of the vast metal wings and the soles of the great angel's feet, and the sky she could see around the edges.
No wind, anyway. Should be fine.
Then they were counting down and casting off. And just like that, they were flying. The five in the citadel gathered on Sarai's terrace, watching, watching, watching the city. The five in the citadel gathered on Sarai's terrace, watching, watching, watching the city. If you stared at it long enough, it became an abstract pattern. The circle of the amphitheatre, dead centre in the oval formed by the outer walls, which were broken by the four hulking monoliths of the anchors. The streets were mazy. They tempted you to trace pathways with your eyes, finding routes between this place and that. All the godspawn had done it, save Minya, who alone never yearned to see it closer.
Maybe they aren't coming,
said Feral, hoping. Ever since Sarai told him about the Silk Slay's vulnerability, he'd been thinking about it, wondering what he would do if, when, it came down to it. Would he defy Minya, or disappoint Sarai? Which was the safer course? Even now he was uncertain. If only they wouldn't come, he wouldn't have to choose. Choosing wasn't Feral's strong suit.
There!
Sparrow pointed, her hand trembling. She still held the flowers she'd been weaving into Sarai's hair, torch ginger blossoms, like the ones she'd put on Ruby's cake, for wishing. Except that these weren't buds. They were open blooms, as gorgeous as fireworks. She'd already done Ruby's hair, and Ruby had done hers. All three of them wore wishes in their hair today. Now Sarai's hearts lurched. They seemed to slam together. She leaned forward, resting against the slope of the angel's hand to peer over the edge and follow the line of Sparrow's finger down to the rooftops.
No, no, no,
she said inside her head. But she saw it. A flicker of red, rising from the pavilion of the guild hall. They were coming. Disengaging from the city, leaving rooftops and spires and domes behind. The shape grew larger, steadily more distinct, and soon Sarai could make out four figures. Her hearts went on slamming. Her father. Of course he was one of the four. He was easy to discern at a distance for the size of him. Sarai swallowed hard. She had never seen him with her own eyes. A wave of emotion surged through her. And it wasn't wrath, and it wasn't hate. It was longing. To be someone's child. Her throat felt thick. She bit her lip. And all too soon they were risen close enough that she could make out the other passengers. She recognized Azarine, and would have expected no less from the woman who had loved Errol Fane for so long. The pilot was the older Ferengi woman, and the fourth passenger... The fourth passenger was Laszlo. His face was upturned. He was still too distant to make out clearly, but she knew it was him.
Why hadn't he listened to her? Why hadn't he believed her?
Well, he would believe soon enough. Waves of hot and cold flushed through her, chased by despair. Minya's army was waiting just inside the open door in Sarai's room, ready to ambush the humans the moment they landed. They would swarm over them with their knives and cleavers and meat hooks. The humans wouldn't stand a chance. Minya stood there like the small general she was, intent and ready.
All right,
she said, fixing Sarai and Feral, Ruby and Sparrow with her cool, bright gaze.
Everyone, get out of sight,
she ordered. And Sarai watched as the others obeyed.
Minya,
she began.
Now!
Snapped Minya. Sarai didn't know what to do. The humans were coming. Carnage was at hand. Numbly, she followed the others, wishing it were a nightmare from which she could awaken. It wasn't like soaring. There was nothing of the bird in this steady ascension. They floated upward, rather, like a very large ulola blossom, with a bit more control than the windborne flowers had. Aside from the pontoons, which were sewn of specially treated red silk and contained ulola gas, there was another bladder, this one under the craft, filled with air by means of a foot pedal bellows. It wasn't for lift, but propulsion. By means of a number of outflow valves, Solzarin could control thrust in different directions, forward, backward, side to side. There was a mast and sail, too, that worked just like a sailing ship if the winds were favorable. Laszlo had witnessed test flights in Thanagost, and the sight of the sleighs scudding across the skies under full sail had been magical. Looking down, he saw people in the streets and on terraces, growing steadily smaller until the sleigh had drifted so far above the city that it spread out like a map. They came even with the lowermost part of the citadel, the feet. Up and up, past the knees, the long, smooth thighs, up to the torso, seeming draped in robes of gossamer. All Mazarthium and solid, but so cunningly shaped you could see the jut of hip bones, as though through diaphanous cloth. Whatever else he had been, Scathis had also been an artist. In order to cast the greatest shadow, the wings were fanned out in an immense circle, with the scapular feathers touching in the back, the secondaries forming the middle of the ring, and the long, sleek primaries reaching all the way around to come parallel to the seraph's outstretched arms. The silk sleigh rose up through the gap between the arms, coming even with the chest. As he squinted up at the underside of the chin, color caught Laszlo's eyes. Green. Swathes of green below the collarbones, stretching from one shoulder to the other. They were the trees that dropped their plums on the district called Windfall, Laszlo thought. It occurred to him to wonder how, with so little rainfall, they were still alive.
Feral, Sarai implored. Please!
Feral's jaw clenched. He didn't look at her. If she were asking him not to do something, he wondered if it would be easier than to do something. He glanced at Minya.
This doesn't have to happen, Sarai went on. If you call clouds right now, you can still force them back. Close your mouth,
said Minya, her voice like ice, and Sarai saw that it infuriated her that she couldn't compel the living to obey her as easily as she did the dead.
Minya,
she pleaded,
so long as no one's died, there's hope of finding some other way. So long as no one's died,
repeated Minya. She gave a high laugh.
Then I'd say it's 15 years too late for hope.
Sarai closed her eyes and opened them again.
I mean, now. So long as no one's died, now. If it's not today, then it's tomorrow or the next day. When there's an unpleasant job to do, it's best to get it over with. Putting it off won't help. It might,
said Sarai.
How? I don't know. Keep your voice down,
Minya hissed.
You do understand that a necessary condition for ambush is surprise.
Sarai stared at her face, so hard and uncompromising, and again saw Scathis in the set of her features, even the shape of them. If Minya had gotten Scathis's power, she wondered, would she be any different from him? Or would she willingly subjugate a whole population and justify it all within the rigid parameters of justice? How had this small, damaged child ruled them for so long. It struck her now as ridiculous. Might there have been another way from the very start? What if Sarai had never given a single nightmare? What if, from the beginning, she had soothed the fears of Weep instead of stoking them? Might she have diffused all this hatred? No, even she couldn't believe that. For 200 years it had been building. What could she have hoped to accomplish in 15? She would never know. She had never been given a choice, and now it was too late. These humans were going to die. And then, when the Silk Sleigh and its passengers failed to return, would they send the other up after it, so more could die? And then, who knows how much time it would buy them, how many more months or years they would have of this purgatorial existence before a bigger, bolder attack came. More crafts, Tyzerkane leaping from ships like pirates boarding a vessel. Or the clever outsiders would come up with some grand plan to scuttle the citadel. Or suppose the humans simply cut their losses and abandoned Weep, leaving a ghost town for them to lord over. Sarai imagined it empty, all those mazy lanes and mussed-up beds deserted, and she felt, for a staggering moment, as though she were drowning in that emptiness. She imagined her moths drowning in silence, and it felt like the end of the world. Only one thing was sure, whatever happened. From this moment on, the five of them would be like ghosts, pretending they were still alive. Sarai wanted to say all this, but it tangled up inside of her. She'd held her tongue for too long. It was too late. She caught a flash of red through the open door and knew it was the Silk Sleigh, though her first thought was of blood.
Everyone will die!
Minya's expression was predatory, eager. Her grubby little hand was poised to give the signal, and...
No!
Sarai cried, shoving her aside and darting forward. She pushed through the throng of ghosts, and they were as solid as living bodies, but with none of the warmth and give. She bumped against a knife held fast in a ghost's grip. Its blade slid over her forearm as she thrust her way past. It was so sharp she felt it only as a line of heat. Blood flowed fast, and when a ghost grabbed for her wrist, the slickness made her hard to hold. She twisted free and darted into the doorway. The Silk Sleigh was there, maneuvering to a landing. They were already turned in her direction, and startled when she appeared. The pilot was busy with her levers, but the other three stared at her. Errol Fane's and Azarine's hands sprang to the hilts of their hreshteks. Laszlo, amazed, said,
"You!"
And Sarai, with a sob, screamed,
"Go!"
Chapter 39 Uncanny Enemies. Trees that should have been dead. Movement where there should have been stillness. A figure in the doorway of a long-abandoned citadel. Where there ought to have been naught but desertion and old death, there was... her. Laszlo's first instinct was to doubt he was awake. The goddess of despair was dead and he was dreaming. But he knew the latter at least wasn't true. He felt Errol Fane's sudden stillness, saw his great hand freeze on his hilt, his hreshtek but half-drawn. Azarine's wasn't. It came free with a deadly shink. All this was periphery. Laszlo couldn't turn aside to see. He couldn't tear his eyes away from her. She had red flowers in her hair. Her eyes were wide and desperate. Her voice, it carved a tunnel through the air. It was rough and scouring, like rusty anchor chain reeling through a hawse. She was struggling. Hands caught at her from within. Whose hands? She gripped the sides of the doorway, but the Mazathian was smooth. There was no frame, nothing to give her purchase. And there were too many hands, grabbing at her arms and hair and shoulders. She had nothing to hold on to. Laszlo wanted to leap to her defense. Their eyes met. The look was like the scorch of lightning. Her scouring cry still echoed.
Go!
And then she was gone, ripped back into the citadel. As others came pouring out. Solzarin had, in the instant of the cry, reversed thrust on the sleigh, sending it scudding gently backward. Gently was its only speed, except under sail with a good stiff breeze. Laszlo stood rooted, experiencing the full meaning of useless as a wave of enemies hurtled toward them, moving with uncanny fluidity, flying at them as though launched. He had no sword to draw, and nothing to do but stand and watch. Errol Fane and Azarine stood squarely before him and Solzarin, guarding them from this impossible onslaught. Too many, too swift. They boiled like bees from a hive. He couldn't understand what he was seeing. They were coming. They were fast. They were here. Steel on steel. The sound. A squeak cut straight to his hearts. He couldn't stand empty-handed, useless, in such a storm of steel. There were no extra weapons. There was nothing but the padded pole Solzarin kept for pushing the sleigh clear of obstacles when maneuvering to a landing. He grabbed it and faced the fray. The attackers had knives, not swords. Kitchen knives. And their shortened reach brought them well inside the warrior's strike zone. If they were ordinary foes, it might have been possible to defend against them with great broad slashes that gutted two or three at a time. But they weren't ordinary foes. It was plain to see they weren't soldiers at all. They were men and women of all ages, some white-haired, and some not even yet adults. Errol Fane and Azarine were deflecting blows, sending kitchen knives skittering over the metal surface of the terrace that was still beneath the sleigh. Azarine gasped at the sight of one old woman, and Laszlo noted the way her sword arm fell limp to her side.
Nana?
She said, stunned, and he watched, unblinking, horrified, as the woman raised a mallet, the studded metal sort for pounding cutlets, and brought it arcing down right at Azarine's head. There was no conscious thought in it. Laszlo's arms did the thinking. He brought the pole up, and just in time. The mallet smashed into it, and it smashed into Azarine. He couldn't prevent it. The force of the blow, immense for an old woman, was too great. But the pole was padded with batting and canvas, and it stopped Azarine's skull from being staved in. Her sword arm jerked back to life. She knocked the pole away and shook her head to clear it, and Laszlo saw. He saw her blade cut right through the old woman's arm. Right through. And nothing happened. The arm, her substance, it simply rearranged itself around the weapon and became whole again after it had passed through. There wasn't even blood. It all came clear. These enemies were not mortal, and they could not be harmed. The realization struck them all, just at the moment that the sleigh glided finally free of the terrace and back into open sky, widening the distance from the metal hand and the army of dead it held. There was a feeling of escape, a moment to gasp for breath. But it was false. The attackers kept coming. They vaulted off the terrace, mindless of the distance. They leapt into the open sky and failed to fall. There was no escape. The attackers crashed onto the sleigh. Ghosts poured from the angel's huge metal hand, wielding knives and meat hooks, and the Tizercane fought them off blow by blow. Laszlo stood between the warriors and Solzarin, wielding the pole. An attacker slipped around the side, a man with a moustache, and Laszlo cut him in half with a swing, only to watch the halves of him reform like something from a nightmare. The trick was the weapons, he thought, remembering the mallet. He struck again with the pole, aiming for the man's hand, and knocked the knife from his grip. It clattered to the floor of the sleigh. This unnatural army was entirely untrained, But what did that matter? There was no end to them, and they could not die. What is skill in such a fight? The ghost with the moustache, unarmed now, launched at Solzarin, and Laszlo thrust himself between them. The ghost grabbed for the pole. Laszlo held on. They grappled. Behind the figure, he could see all the rest of them. The swarm of them with their blank faces and staring, harrowed eyes, and he couldn't wrest the pole free. The ghost's strength was unnatural. He wouldn't tire. Laszlo was helpless when the next attacker slipped around the Tizerkane's guard. A young woman with haunted eyes, a meat hook in her hands. She raised it, brought it down. On the starboard pontoon, puncturing it. The sleigh lurched. Solzarin cried out. Gas hissed through the hole, and the sleigh began to spin. It was at just this moment when it occurred to Laszlo that he was going to die, exactly as he had been warned, impossibly in a dream, that the ghost he was grappling with lost solidity. Laszlo saw his hands, one moment so hard and real on the wood of the pole, melt right through it. The same thing happened to the young woman. The meat hook fell from her grip, though she never loosed her hold on it. It fell right through her hand and into the sleigh. And then, the strangest thing, a look of sweetest, purest relief came over her face, even as she began to fade from sight. Laszlo could see through her. She closed her eyes and smiled and was gone. The man with the moustache was next. An instant, and his face lost its blankness, flushed with the delirium of release. And then he vanished too. The ghosts were melting. They had gone beyond some boundary and been set free. Not all of them were so lucky. Most were sucked backward like kites on strings, reeled back to the metal hand to watch as the sleigh, spinning slowly, scudded farther and farther out of their reach. No time to wonder. The starboard pontoon was leaking gas. The sleigh was keeling over.
Laszlo!
Barked Solzarin, pushing her goggles up onto her forehead.
Shift your weight to port, and hold on!
He did as she commanded, his weight balancing the tilt of the craft as she slapped a patch onto the hissing hole the meat hook had made. The weapon still lay on the floor, dull and deadly, and the knife that had fallen there too. Azarine and Errol Fane were gasping for breath, their hreshtek still drawn, shoulders heaving. They checked each other frantically for injuries. Both were bleeding from cuts to their hands and arms, but that was all. Amazingly, no one had sustained a serious injury. Drawing a deep breath, Azarine turned to Laszlo.
You saved my life, Ferengi.
Laszlo almost said,
You're welcome.
But she hadn't actually thanked him, so he held it back and only nodded. He hoped it was a dignified nod, maybe even a little tough. He doubted it, though. His hands were shaking. His everything was shaking. The sleigh had stopped its spinning, but was still listing. They'd lost just enough gas for a slow descent. Solzarin raised the sail and sheeted it, bringing the bow around and aiming for the meadows outside the city walls. That was good. It would give them time to catch their breath before the others could reach them. The thought of the others and all the questions they would ask jolted Laszlo out of his survival euphoria and back into reality. Questions. Questions required answers. What were the answers? He looked to Errol Fane.
What just happened?
He asked. The Godslayer stood a good while with his hands on the rail, leaning heavily, looking away. Laszlo couldn't see his face, but he could read his shoulders. Something very heavy was pressing there. Very heavy indeed. He thought of the girl on the terrace, the girl from the dream, and asked,
Was that Isagol?
No,
said Errol Fane, sharp.
Isagol is dead.
Then, who? Laszlo might have asked more, but Azarine caught his eye and warned him off with a look. She was badly shaken. They were silent for the rest of the descent. The landing was soft as a whisper, the craft skimming over the tall grass until Soldarin dropped the sail and they came at last to a halt. Laszlo helped her secure it, and they climbed back onto the surface of the world. They were out from under the citadel here. The sun was bright, and the crisp line of shadow, downhill, made a visible border. Against that harsh line where darkness began, Laszlo caught a glimpse of the white bird, wheeling and tilting. It was always there, he thought, always watching.
"They'll get here soon, I reckon," said Soldarin.
She pulled off her goggles and wiped her brow with her arm.
"Oswin won't tarry."
The Godslayer nodded. He was silent another moment, collecting himself, before he picked up the dropped knife and meat hook from the floor of the silk sleigh and hurled them away. He drew a hard breath and spoke.
"I won't order you to lie," he said slowly. "But I'm asking you to. I'm asking that we keep this to ourselves, until I can think what to do about it." It?
The ghosts? The girl? This utter upending of what the citizens of Weep thought they knew about the citadel they already feared with such cold, debilitating dread? What manner of dread would this new truth inspire? Laszlo shuddered to think of it.
"We can't. We can't simply do nothing," said Azarine.
"I know," said Errol Fane, ravaged. "But if we tell, there will be panic. And if we try to attack," he swallowed. "Azarine, did you see?"
"Of course I did," she whispered.
Her words were so raw. She hugged her arms around herself. Laszlo thought they should have been Errol Fane's arms. Even he could see that. But Errol Fane was trapped in his own shock and grief, and kept his great arms to himself.
"Who were they?"
Soldarin asked.
"What were they?"
Slowly, like a dancer dropping into a curtsy that keeps going all the way to the ground, Azarine sank down onto the grass.
"All our debt," she said, "turned against us."
Her eyes were hard and bright. Laszlo turned to Errol Fane.
"Did you know?"
he asked him.
"When we were taking off, I asked if you were certain it was empty, and you said, empty of the living."
Errol Fane closed his eyes. He rubbed them.
"I didn't mean ghosts," he said, stumbling on the word. "I meant bodies."
He seemed almost to be hiding his face in his hands, and Laszlo knew there were still secrets.
"But the girl," he said, tentative. "She was neither."
Errol Fane dropped his hands from his eyes.
"No."
With anguish, and a stark glimmer of something, redemption, he whispered,
"She's alive."
Part 4. Sathars. Noun. The desire to possess that which can never be yours. Archaic. From the tale of Sathars, who fell in love with the moon. Chapter 40. Mercy. What had Sarai just done? After it was over, and they had watched, all five of them, over the edge of the terrace, as the silk sleigh escaped down to a far green meadow, Minya turned to her, unspeaking, unable to speak, and her silence was worse than screaming could have been. The little girl shook with ill-contained fury, and when the silence stretched on, Sarai forced herself to really look at Minya. What she saw wasn't just fury. It was a wilderness of disbelief and betrayal.
"That man killed us, Sarai,"
she hissed when she finally found her voice.
"You might forget that, but I never can. We aren't dead."
At that moment, Sarai truly wasn't sure that Minya knew that. Maybe all she knew was ghosts and could make no distinction.
"Minya,"
she said, pleading.
"We're still alive.
Because I saved us from him!"
She was shrill. Her chest heaved. She was so thin inside her ragged garment.
"So that you could save him from me! Is that how you thank me?"
"No!"
Sarai burst out.
"I thanked you by doing everything you ever told me to do! I thanked you by being your wrath for you every night, for years, no matter what it did to me. But it was never enough. It will never be enough."
Minya looked incredulous.
"Are you mad you had to keep us safe? I'm so sorry it was hard for you. Perhaps we should have waited on you and never made you use your nasty gift."
"That's not what I'm saying. You twist everything."
Sarai was shaking.
"There might have been another way. You made the choice. You chose nightmares. I was too young to know better. You used me like one of your ghosts."
She was choking on her own words, astonished at herself for speaking so. She saw Feral, stricken dumb, his mouth actually agape.
"So in turn, you betrayed me. You betrayed us all. I might have chosen for you once, Sarai, but today, the choice was all yours."
Her chest rose and fell with animal breathing. Her shoulders were frail as bird bones.
"And you chose them!"
She shrieked the last part. Her face went red. Tears burst from her eyes. Sarai had never seen her cry before. Not ever. Even her tears were fierce and angry. No gentle, tragic trails like the ones that painted Ruby's and Sparrow's cheeks. Minya's tears raged, practically leaping from her eyes in full, fat drops like rain. Everyone was frozen. Sparrow, Ruby, Feral. They were stunned. They looked from Sarai to Minya, Minya to Sarai, and seemed to be holding their breath. And when Minya wheeled on them, pointed at the door, and commanded,
"You three, get out!"
They hesitated, torn, but not for long. It was Minya they feared, her icy tantrums, her scalding disappointment, and her they were used to obeying. If Sarai had, in that moment, presented them with a choice, if she had stood proud and defended her actions, she might have won them to her. She didn't, though. Her uncertainty was written all over her, in her two wide eyes and trembling lip, and the way she held her bloody arm limp against her middle. Ruby clung to Feral and turned away when he did. Sparrow was last to go. She cast a frightened glance back from the doorway and mouthed the words,
"I'm sorry."
Sarai watched her leave. Minya stood there a moment longer, looking at Sarai as though she were a stranger. When she spoke again, her voice had lost its shrillness, its fury. It was flat and old. She said,
"Whatever happens now, Sarai, it will be your fault."
And she spun on her heel and stalked through the door, leaving Sarai alone with the ghosts. All the anger was sucked away in her wake, and it left a void. What else was there when you took away the anger the hate. The ghosts stood frozen, those who remained. The ones Minya had yanked back from the brink of freedom, while others crossed out of her reach and escaped her. And they couldn't turn their heads to look at Sarai, but their eyes strained toward her. And she thought that she saw grace there, and gratitude. For her mercy. Mercy. Was it mercy or betrayal? Salvation or doom? Maybe it was all those things flashing like a flipped coin, end over end. Mercy, betrayal, salvation, doom. And how would it come down? How would it all end? Heads and the humans live. Tails, the godspawn die. The outcome had been rigged from the day they were born. A coldness seeped into Sarai's hearts. Minya's army appalled her. But what would have happened today if it hadn't been here? If Errol Fane had come, expecting to find skeletons, and found them instead? She was left with the desolate certainty that her father would have done again what he did 15 years ago. His face was fixed in her mind. Haunted to start with, just to be returning to this place of his torment. Then startled, then stricken by the sight of her. She'd witnessed the precise moment when he understood. It was so very fast. The first blanch of shock, when he thought she was Isagol, and the second, when he realized she wasn't. When he grasped who she was. Horror. That was what she had seen on his face, and nothing short of it. She had believed she had hardened herself to any further pain he could cause her. But she'd been wrong. This was the first time in her life that she had seen him with her own eyes, not filtered through Moth's senses or conjured in his own unconscious or Suhaila's or Azarine's, but him, the man whose blood was half her own, her father. And his horror at the sight of her had opened a new blossom of shame in her. Obscenity, calamity, godspawn. And on the dreamer's face, shock, alarm. Sarai could hardly say. It had all happened in a blink, and all the while the ghosts were wrenching her out of the doorway, dragging her back inside. Her arm. It hurt. She looked down. Blood was crusted dark from her forearm to her fingers, and still oozing bright from the long line of the cut. There were bruises blooming, too, where the ghosts had gripped her. The pulsing pain made it feel like their hands were still on her. She wanted Great Ellen, her gentle touch to clean and wrap her wound, and her compassion. With resolve, she made to leave. But ghosts blocked her way. For a moment, she didn't grasp what was happening. She'd grown accustomed to their presence, always steeling herself when she had to pass through a cluster of them. But they had never interfered with her before. Now, no sooner did she make for the door than they glided together, preventing her passing. She faltered to a stop. Their faces were impassive as ever. She knew better than to speak to them as though they were under their own control. But the words came out anyway.
What? Am I not allowed to leave?
Of course they didn't answer. They had their orders and would obey them. And Sarai would not be going anywhere. All day long, nobody came. Ostracized, isolated, and wearier than she had ever been. She rinsed her arm with the last water from her pitcher, and bandaged it with a slip she tore into strips. She kept to her sleeping alcove, as though she were hiding from the ghost guards. Hot waves of panic crashed through her each time she remembered, afresh, the chaos of the morning, and the choice that she had made.
Whatever happens now, it will be your fault.
She hadn't meant to choose. In her heart, she had never and could never make that choice. Humans over her own kind. That wasn't what she'd done. She wasn't a traitor. But she wasn't a murderer either. Pacing, she felt as though her life had chased her down a dead-end corridor and trapped her there to taunt her. Trapped, trapped, trapped. Perhaps she had always been a prisoner, but not like this. The walls closed in around her. She wanted to know what was happening down in Weep, and what nature of uproar had greeted the news of her existence. Errol Fane must have told them by now. They would be gathering weapons, talking strategy. Would they come back up in greater numbers? Could they? How many silk sleighs did they have? She'd only seen two, but they looked easy to build. She supposed it was just a matter of time until they could field an invasion force. Did Minya think her army could hold them off forever? Sarai pictured a life in which they went on as before, but under siege now, alert to attacks at all hours of the day or night, repelling warriors, pushing corpses off her terrace to plunge all the way down to the city below like so many windfall plums. Feral would call rain showers to rinse away the blood, and they would all sit down to dinner while Minya bound the day's new batch of dead into her service. Sarai shuddered. She felt so helpless. The day was bright, and it went on and on. Her craving for Lull was powerful, but there was no more Grey waiting for her now, no matter how much Lull she drank. She was so tired, she felt. Threadbare, like the soles of old slippers. But she didn't dare close her eyes. Her terror of what awaited her just over the threshold of consciousness was more powerful still. She wasn't well. Ghosts without, horrors within, and nowhere to turn. Her shining blue walls hemmed her in. She wept, waiting for nightfall, and finally it came. Never before had her silent scream been such a release. She screamed everything, and felt as though her very being broke apart in the soft scatter of wings. Translated into moths, Sarai surged out the windows and siphoned herself away. The sky was huge and there was freedom in it. The stars called to her like signal beacons burning on a vast black sea as she flung herself a hundredfold into the dizzy air. Escape, escape. She flew away from nightmares and privation and the turned backs of her kindred. She flew away from the dead-end corridor where her life had trapped and taunted her. She flew away from herself. A wild desire gripped her to fly as far as she could from Weep. 100 moths, 100 directions. To fly and fly till sunrise came and turned her to smoke and all her misery too.
"Kill yourself, girl,"
the old woman had said.
"Have mercy on us all."
Mercy. Mercy. Would it be mercy to put an end to herself? Sarai knew those vicious words had come not from old ghost women, but her own innermost self. Guilt poison from 4,000 nights of dark dreams. She also knew that in all of the city, and in the monstrous metal angel that had stolen the sky, she was the only one who knew the suffering of humans and Godspawn both. And it came to her that her mercy was singular and precious. Today, it had forestalled carnage, at least for a time. The future was blind, but she couldn't feel, truly, that it would be better without her in it. She gathered herself from her wild scatter. She gave up the sky with its signal fire stars, and flew instead down to Weep, to find out what her mercy had set in motion. Chapter 41. Witchlight. The goddess was real, and she was alive. Laszlo had dreamed her before he knew the Mizarthim were blue, and that had seemed uncanny enough. How much more now that he'd seen her alive? Her lovely face an exact match to the one in his dreams. It was no coincidence. It could only be magic. When wagons arrived to retrieve the downed silk sleigh and its passengers, the four of them stuck to a simple story of mechanical failure, which was questioned by no one. They downplayed the event to such a degree that the day carried on as usual, though Laszlo felt as though he'd left usual behind forever. He processed everything as well as could be expected, considering that everything entailed near death at the hands of savage ghosts. And he found within himself, rising through all the consternation and fright, a strange bubble of gladness. The girl from his dreams wasn't a figment, and she wasn't the goddess of despair, and she wasn't dead. All day long he kept tipping back his head to look up at the citadel with new eyes, knowing she was inside it. How was it possible? How was any of it possible? Who was she, and how had she come into his dreams? He was fretful as he laid himself down to sleep that night, hoping that she would return. Unlike the previous night, when he'd sprawled face down on the bed, shirtless and unself-conscious, without even tying the drawstring of his breeches, tonight he was prey to a peculiar formality. He put on a shirt, tied his drawstring, tied back his hair. He even glanced at himself in the mirror, and felt foolish to be concerned for his appearance, as though she would somehow see him. He had no idea how it worked, this magic. She was up there, and he was down here. But he couldn't shake the feeling that he was expecting a visitor, which would have been a new experience for him in any setting, but was particularly, provocative in this one. To be lying in bed, waiting for a goddess to pay him a call. He blushed. Of course it wasn't like that. He stared at the ceiling, a tension in his limbs, and felt as though he were acting the part of a sleeper in a play. It wouldn't do. He had to actually fall asleep in order to dream, and it wasn't coming easily, with his mind racing from the mania of the day. There was a kind of euphoria, he had discovered, in nearly dying and then not. Add to that his anxiousness as to whether she would come. He was all nerves and fascination and bashfulness and a deep, stirring hope. He remembered, marveling, how he had taken her hand last night and held it in his own, sensing the realness of it and of her and the connection that had blazed between them when he had. In reality, he would never have dared to do such a bold thing. But he couldn't quite convince himself that it wasn't reality in its way. It hadn't occurred in the physical realm, that much was true. His hand had not touched her hand, but his mind had touched her mind. And that seemed to him a deeper reality and even greater intimacy. She had gasped when he touched her, and her eyes had flown wide. It had been real to her too, he thought. Her lashes, he recalled, were golden red, her eyes pellucid blue, and he remembered how she had looked at him as though transfixed, the first time, nights ago, and again last night. No one had ever looked at him like that before. It made him want to check the mirror again to see what she had seen, if perhaps his face had improved without his knowing it. And the impulse was so vain and unlike him that he flung an arm over his eyes and laughed at himself. His laughter subsided. He remembered, too, the welling blood and her warning. Everyone will die. And the furious way she had grappled in the doorway of the citadel, fighting to warn him yet again. He would be dead if it weren't for her.
Go!
She had screamed as hands caught at her, reeling her back inside. How fierce and desperate she had looked. Was she all right? Had she been hurt? In what conditions did she exist? What was her life? There was so much he wanted to know. Everything. He wanted to know everything, and he wanted to help. Back in Zosma, when Errol Fane had stood before the scholars and spoken with shadowed countenance of Weep's problem, Laszlo had been overcome by this same deep desire. To help, as though someone like him had any chance of solving a problem like this. It struck him as he lay here, with his arms slung across his eyes, that the girl was tied up in Weep's problem in ways he could not yet understand. One thing was clear to him, though. She wasn't safe, and she wasn't free, and Weep's problem had just grown much more complicated. Whom had she defied with that scream, he wondered. and what price might she have paid for it? Worrying about her redoubled his anxiety and pushed sleep even further away, so that he feared it would never come. He was anxious that he might miss her visit, as though his dreams were a door she might even now be knocking on and finding no one at home.
"Wait," he thought. "Please wait for me."
And finally he calmed himself with what he thought of, self-mockingly, as housekeeping concerns. He'd never had a guest before, and he didn't know how to go about it. How to receive her if she came, and where? If there were etiquette guidelines for hosting goddesses in one's dreams, he had never found that book at the Great Library. It wasn't simply a question of parlors and tea trays, though there was that too. If she were coming in reality, he would be limited by reality. But dreams were a different matter. He was Strange the Dreamer. This was his realm. And there were no limits here. Sarai watched the dreamer fling his arm across his eyes. She heard him laugh. She took note of his unnatural stillness, recognizing it as restrained restlessness, and waited impatiently for it to soften into sleep. A moth was perched in a shadowed corner of the window casement, and she waited there a long time after he fell still, trying to determine when he had truly crossed over. His arm was still crooked over his face, and without being able to see his eyes, she couldn't tell if he might be faking. Ambush was on her mind, for obvious reasons, and she couldn't reconcile the violence of the morning with the quiet of this night. She had found none of the panic or preparation that she had expected. The damaged silk sleigh had been hauled back to its pavilion, and there it lay, forlorn, one pontoon deflated. The mechanist pilot was asleep in her bed, her head on her husband's shoulder, and though the earlier chaos flared through her dreams, and his in smaller measure, the rest of the outsiders were untroubled. Sarai's determination, from her moth's gleanings of the night's first crop of dreams, was that Solzarin had told her husband, but no one else, of the encounter at the Citadel. The Zaydin were all likewise in the dark. No panic, no awareness, that Sarai could tell, of the threat that lurked over their heads. Had Errol Fane kept it secret? Why would he? If only she could ask him. In fact, at the same time that her moth was perched in the window casement, watching sleep claim Laszlo Strange, Sarai was watching it not claim the Godslayer. She had found him. She hadn't even been looking. Just assuming he'd be missing, as he had been all these nights, Sarai had nightly called on Azarine and found her all alone. Really, she still was alone. She was in her bed, curled in a ball with her hands over her face, not asleep, as Errol Fane was likewise not asleep in the small sitting room just outside the door. Chairs pushed aside, and a bedroll laid out on the floor. He wasn't lying on it, though. His back was to the wall, and his face was in his hands. Two rooms, door closed between them. Two warriors with their faces in their hands. Sarai, watching them, could see that everything would be better if the faces and hands were to simply switch places. That is, if Azarine were to hold Errol Fane while he held her. How anguished they both were, and how still and quiet and determined to suffer alone. From Sarai's vantage point, she beheld two private pools of suffering, so close together they were nearly adjacent, like the connecting rooms with the shut door between them. Why not open the door and open their arms and close them again around each other? Did they not understand how, in the strange chemistry of human emotion, his suffering and hers, mingled together, could countervail each other? At least for a time. Sarai wanted to feel scorn for them for being such fools, but she knew too much to ever scorn them. For years she'd seen Azarine's love for Errol Fane blasted in the bud like sparrow's orchids by one of Feral's blizzards. And why? because the great Godslayer was incapable of love, because of what Izogol had done to him. And, as Sarai had slowly